Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. In this podcast, we tackle the tough, often unspoken realities of motherhood, neurodiversity, and mental health.
There's a particular kind of exhaustion that happens at 3 o'clock. The teacher says, oh, they had a great day. But then when the car door shuts, your child like collapses in the back of the car. You think, oh my God, how did that teacher say, I wish I had more like her? Because that's not what you're seeing. If you've ever thought, how can my child be fine at school, but then be completely in a mess at home, then this is the episode for you. Because today we are unpacking the cost of being a good student. And we have Bronnie Hammond-Vail back again. How are you, Bronnie?
I'm really good. Thank you so much for welcoming me back.
If you haven't listened to last week's episode, Bronnie Hammond was on again. Please go back and check it out. Bronnie is an autistic and ADHDer. She was diagnosed late at 35 and she's worked across multiple education systems. She's taught ADHD-only classes. She's also helped open a school for disengaged youth and she's raising neurodivergent children herself. What I loved about Bronnie's guest form is that she gets both sides of it. She gets the parent experience and the teacher experience. And Bronnie, I'm so glad you're back for this one.
Yeah, I'm very excited.
So, opening frame. This is probably the topic that is the closest to my heart, which means it's going to be the most difficult for me to stay on track. And Bronnie is probably the most difficult guest that I've had to keep on track. And we're in my area and her area of passion. So I am super worried about where we're going to go on this, but we are going to be going. What I'm going to assume and what I've said to Bronnie is that we are going to assume that everybody listening to this podcast understands the basics around masking, around the collapse, around internalizing and externalizing children. If you are listening and you're like, I don't know what any of those words mean, in the show notes, I'm going to put in episodes from Millie Carr's. I'm going to put in episodes from the school series in 2025 when I went into that really deeply with Millie Carr. I'm going to put those episodes in. If you are still wanting to have that understanding or you're wanting to refresh, please go back to those episodes, click there, and then come back to this one. I was just talking to Bronnie, who is a massive podcast fan apparently.
Yes.
About the fact that I love that even when listeners find me now, they always pretty much the analytics show go right back to the beginning. So I love to keep this, I love to keep the current episodes at a high advanced level for people that have been with me from the beginning, such as yourself, Bronnie. So it's been so nice to have you here. I always prioritize Australians, no matter what kind of following they've got, no matter who they are. I get them on regardless if I like their guest form. So we often hear a lot from guests on this podcast that many other places don't have, because in my opinion, there are so many guests with such great knowledge to share that don't get a platform because they don't have a following or whatever it is yet. That's not what we do here. We go after the real lived raw experience, and that is why you're here, Bronnie.
Yeah, thank you.
So what better way to jump into the deep end and just fucking go it, and it is going to be to listen, and it is going to be to hear from a listener.
Yeah.
Get ready, Bronnie.
Okay, I'm ready. No, barely.
I went through my headphones. Oh, I started recording one back. I'll do that. Hang on, I can go back from you. Okay, and here it is.
Hey, Jane, my ADHD daughter's teacher in year 5 did not attempt to build a relationship with her and had no idea about girl presenting autism and masking. She repeatedly told her to just ask for what she wants and tell her if she needs things. But she has autism, which is a huge communication difference. She was not flexible with her teaching approach for my daughter, who felt like she was not one of her teacher's quote-unquote favorites all year. School refusal started, and due to all the time she had off, started to be left out of her friend group, who then started bullying her.
Yeah. That's a good opener.
It is, and I'm getting a little teary. so I can really relate to your listener's question, particularly around myself being a child who, had teachers like that, and as well as a daughter who masks and has, you know, I've heard people say to her, hey, you need to ask for what you need in class. That's really hard when you are that child because you don't necessarily know what your own needs are in that moment. So I find that question and very upsetting for that parent and that child, particularly when there is a child, I guess a rigid adult in the teacher and not engaging, and then that has caused school refusal for that child. That's heartbreaking and wrong. So wrong.
Oh, it is. And, you know, the whole podcast and the whole school series so far has really focused on a lot of those externalizing behaviors. They're kids that are looking, the kids that are maybe throwing, punching, disrupting classrooms. We've talked about that in the school series so far. And giving those children what they need, that they so desperately need, and that maybe that behavior is communication that they're not having their needs met. But on the other side of that, we have kids that are internalizing, that desperately need help, that are having a fucking breakdown inside their whole brain, that are not getting any of that help because it is sometimes going towards the externalizing child. But the part that really fucks me right off is that the externalizing child is not what the externalizing child is not getting what they need either. So it's not like we're providing for the externalizing child so freaking well, they're killing it, and we're ignoring the others. We're actually prioritizing the externalizing child, but they're not actually getting what they need either. So how the fuck are we ever going to get to the internalizing children when we are fighting that battle?
Yes, you are fighting a battle in an education system where it is better and easier to try and help the externalizing child, while the child who is quietly falling to pieces in the classroom and trying to make themselves invisible but is not is not causing peers to, you know, not have learning or not causing a lot of difficulties for the teacher, they are then getting left behind, essentially, is what is happening.
It's just so sad because we're actually helping neither. And that does my head in because, you know, as autistic women, I'm all about efficiency. I don't know what it is. When something's inefficient, I just can't fucking stand it. And the inefficiency of the education system, like the amount of money that we spend on that.
Yeah.
And what are we getting? Like fucking a lot of damages.
Absolutely a lot of damages. And we have a system that is so slow to change. Like, I'm sorry. I know it has changed. It's definitely changed from me being in the 90s to me becoming a teacher to my children going into school. But it is so slow to change that I don't think in my own lifetime I will see fundamental impact change. It's out there and it's starting to be done, but it's been done on such a small scale that, you know, the impacts and outcomes in that is not being, it's not hitting it because the education system, the public one, is so large. And that is the system that has to change because that is the one that is most of the communities are using.
I'm going to read a second question, and it's written. And it's from Trisha, and she says, how do I support my autistic and ADHD daughter who is highly masking at school? The school says she's fine, but she melts down as soon as I pick her up. When she's not at school, her capacity is so low that she can only rest and recover. I feel like she's such a low priority because her struggles aren't visible. I'm working so hard in the background just so she can cope through the day. I don't know what to do. And it's really similar to the question we heard from before as well. Like, when you hear that, why doesn't it trigger concern? Like, what's happening in here?
So, first of all, hi, Trisha. Thank you for this question. But I think, the reason it's not causing concern, and I'm sorry to say this, it is because it is not directly impacting the classroom space. And that's heartbreaking for me to say because I have a child, a girl myself, who does the same thing, as well as myself in school. But because we are not being the loud and boisterous and over the, you know, that is not impacting. So they don't see it as the functional impact of their learning in the classroom being affected. Now, I'm not saying it's not, it definitely is. The problem being is that unless the teacher themselves are actively engaging, then they're going to get forgotten.
and they're going to just breeze past why, you know, your daughter, for example, is just going to continuously carry a level of a mental load that will eventually just be too much. It's reality, sadly, and wrong, so wrong.
I'm just going to skip a few questions because they're like the same thing. And we've actually covered it. Like the disruptive people said exactly the same as what you said. So I'm going to skip some of it because I think we're going to end up being a long one anyway. I think the self-advocacy part is the part that I see the most. Mm. We know that the internalizing kids are not going to get the same amount of supports probably. I don't want to generalize it, but they're probably not going to. No. We hear from parents that their school says she's fine, he's fine, and then they're having a full breakdown at home. We hear that all the time. What I do also hear as a part of that is when the parent goes in and says, hey, I really need some help. She's really not coping. He's really having a lot of anxiety. I often hear the teacher will say very kindly often, hey, what do they need? Can they come tell me when they're feeling like that? Mm. And it's this because the teacher doesn't know. And in fairness, how would they know? Mm. Like in fairness to them, they may not have the training. It may not be their child, obviously, either.
Yeah.
And when we're talking about people having a really great mask, camouflaging all of the things, then we're also expecting the teachers to pick up on this magically, know what the child needs when they say they're fine, and put something in place. Like if you actually spell out what you want for that teacher to do, which I've thought in my mind, what do I want the teacher to do? And it's basically impossible.
Yeah, it is actually. I think, though, it is impossible, but I'm going to say this. If you're a teacher and you can be neurotypical or neurodiverse, it doesn't matter. But some stuff that I have found, and this is the key part, developing relationships with your students. And when I say relationships, getting to know them, getting to know their special interests. I know that in some cases like mine where I'm having, you know, a 70-minute class twice a week, you can still do this through playground duty, through after-school clubs. Like there is opportunity to develop those relationships with the students. And part of that is also finding out, like, you can become very insightful when you begin to get to know a student very quickly, and you will then start to see yourself what they are needing. Now, I have had students who could not tell me at all what they needed or what, you know, where they are and things like that. But I had to try to get, I would get to know them. And I was in a unique situation, don't get me wrong. I was in a school where that was an opportunity. But I found through getting to know this student that this student wasn't eating breakfast in the morning, and that was setting them up for a really poor day. They weren't eating breakfast. They were coming to school. They were hungry, which then was causing grumpiness and anger and frustration and things like that. And, you know, then I realized, well, maybe a lot of the kids are potentially having a similar thing. So I started having breakfast for them. Yeah, we would have food. There are so many things through getting to know these kids that you could know. You might know, well, and even just observing at lunchtime when you're on playground duty, if you're in a primary school, for example, you have to watch the kids eating. Are they actively eating during that time, or are they becoming distracted? Do they need to potentially come back to the lunchbox when it's quieter in the classroom while they're doing some work, which could help them engage and maybe have less of a mental load to carry because one of those feelings of not being hungry has gone. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I actually was just thinking then, if we go back to last episode, you were talking about having a toolkit.
Yeah.
And I suppose here you're talking about, like, from your experience being an internalizer and also having an internalizer and also being a teacher, right? Like, there's no better place, there's no better person to know what a toolkit would look like.
Yeah.
So then suggesting, why don't you, okay, I know, do you have breakfast in the morning? Do you need a break? Like, whatever it is,
yeah.
I suppose having that toolkit available for teachers to be like, even if you're not noticing anything, but you know that the parent's saying something, maybe some things to suggest that might work.
So if a parent has come to you, which it sounds like this parent we were talking about earlier has come to the teacher, if I had a parent coming to me going, hey, the mental load at home, like at the end of the day, they are just crashing, it's a burnout, I would then be going, okay, I need to go and have a quick look. And please don't hear me, teachers, if you're hearing this, I know you're busy, but you also observe your students. It's part of your job, like you're observing. So observe, see what's happening that you could assist with that mental load or with that mask that, you know, the parent has just told you they are wearing. You think for all intents and purposes they are. a model student, the parent has just said they are masking, that at the end of the day they are catatonic for 4 hours, then okay, let's have a little bit of a deeper look. Not, don't be weird and creepy and watch them too much, but you can observe some behaviors that you might be able to assist with so that the mental load is less.
I agree. And I suppose what you're saying is, you know, having some of those tools available. So every teacher that gets an email from a parent that says, hey, my daughter who's in grade five, like we opened up with, is masking, whatever it is, you would go, okay, well, I don't really understand this. She looks fine to me,
yep,
but I have these resources, these tools that I know may help them.
Yep.
And so maybe I would suggest some of those, because if the teacher is opening up that email, not knowing what to do, and everyone's problem solving in real time alone, right? Like, it's so ridiculous if you think about that.
And they would also, like, if you're on neurotypical and you open that email, you'd be like, I don't get it. Okay, all right, go and do a little bit of research. But I also think that if you have that toolkit and they have it and they're able to go, okay, well, I don't understand what's been asked. Here's my little resources, my little toolkit of professional knowledge and suggestions and scripts and things like that. I'm going to use that to get to help, to try and assist, to because I've just been told that there's an issue that I didn't see. But I also think if you are in a classroom and you're a teacher in that classroom and you've been told and, you know, the child is masking and all of this, I am finding that a lot of teachers will just push it onto special education, will just push it onto the guidance officer, the counselor, the psychologist in the school. That is, if you are a primary school teacher, you see that child 6 hours a day minus your contact, your non-contact time. So it is not really appropriate in this instance to do that. You need to be using those tools and resources, because I am finding that if they do, sadly, do push them onto the other parts of the school, not because they're not knowing, but because you're right, they don't have the tools or resources, and they're hoping that that other part of the school might be able to assist them. But a lot of the time it looks like that child being taken out of class for a couple of questions and things like that. That's not going to help a child who is highly masking, like is engaging in the learning process. That's not going to help, because it's not, removing them is not the solution. But a lot of the time that's what ends up happening.
So if the teacher reaches out to the special education unit or someone within the school that they feel might be able to help them or help them understand whatever it is, does that actual place help them? Does that external, because you were talking about them taking them out of the classroom, like, I don't think they want to be taken out. I think they want the teacher to
know. It's the teacher, yeah.
But are they actually helping the teacher, the special education unit, or like, what do they just go, oh, I don't know?
So yes and no. If the child is external in their behavior, then absolutely yes. They are helping in that the child might have a timeout card where they 10 minutes go to the special education room and there's a teacher there to supervise for 10 minutes of calm down and regulation and things like that. But when you have a child who is a model student for all intents and purposes, it, in my opinion, doesn't necessarily help. What would help is a stakeholder meeting between the parent, the teacher, and a special education inclusion teacher who might have more resources that the teacher doesn't have in relation to, let's have a learning plan around, asking questions. So for example, a child who heavily masks, they may be able to absolutely answer a question if they are called upon in class. But the level of anxiety that causes could be so astronomical that it's not worth calling them, even if they bloody know the answer. So having that written in a learning plan, please do not call out on that student unless they volunteer themselves. Now, unless they themselves, and that's something you would have a collaborative discussion about. But, and that's the thing, you because they're a model, you assume that they're happy to answer a question if you call, you know, hey, Bobby, what's the answer to 2 + 2? Now, the child may know the answer, but having to answer that question in front of everyone, that could be a part of the masking that's so hard for them. And if you remove that, that's an element that you've taken away. It's not to say that they're not engaging with their learning, because there are other ways to engage other than confirming knowledge verbally across an entire classroom, for example.
I'm just getting flashbacks to, and I'm older than you, so maybe this didn't happen, but I remember being in grade four and we had to line up against a wall. And they had the times tables.
Yep.
And the old lady, who should have been retired a long time ago, would like fire off at you like you were in a machine gun line, right? And it was all really public. They'd have the whole grade. And if you failed, you had to go stand in a certain area, yep, right? And I didn't know, but I have dyscalculia. And I am horrific horrific with numbers. And so I would answer the question perfectly, right? But I would stay up all night doing times tables over and over and over again.
Yep.
The same in the holidays. I remember forcing my grandma to do the 6 timetables with me for like 8 hours because I was so terrified that I would not know the answer. But the experience of that teacher would have been, Jane always knows the answer. She says it confidently, straight up. She's, why is there a problem?
Yeah.
And I noticed when I took my daughter to go look at high schools, she's in grade 5, and that's when they get started up here, is you have to do the interviews in grade 5.
Yes.
So I asked her on the way to the school tour, what is important to you about this high school? Mm. What are you looking for? Because, I mean, I've got my own fucking wits, right?
Yeah.
And she says, I don't want to do any languages. And I'm thinking, well, I hate languages too. And I said, okay, I think they're all going to do languages. So, like, sorry, I think they're going to do languages. Anyway, she's like, I don't want to go to a school with languages. And she's like, all on it, the fucking languages. And I ended up saying about, like, what is it about the languages? That's the problem. And she said, at my school, they say that when you get to grade 10, you have to stand up in front of everybody with a speaker and they are going to make you say your name in a sentence. And whatever it is, and it's like this scare tactic. And she's concerned in grade 5, right? And she started getting concerned about this in grade 2. I remember talking her off a ledge with this at nighttime. She's in grade 5 now, concerned still. And now she hates languages, doesn't want to do it, doesn't want to have anything to do with anything. This is the girl that has a globe in a room and she loves culture. But now she hates languages because of that experience, and I'm looking for a high school that doesn't have languages, which is completely limiting her.
Yeah.
And but if I know, if I said to her Japanese teacher, that freaks her out. She would say, she's a model student, what's the problem?
Yep, yep. And that's the thing, though. I don't feel having to call on a student publicly like that is a way to prove or show that they have taken in that knowledge. And that's a lot of the time, that is a lot of anxiety for kids, neurotypical or neurodiverse. But there are other ways to be able to do that. And so in your daughter's case, you're probably not going to find a school that doesn't have some language because it's written in the damn curriculum they have to follow. But the thing is, you could go, hey, we need to make an accommodation. There is a functional impact in the classroom. That is the level of anxiety that she will experience if you are going to call upon her to say, je m'appelle, whatever, if it's French. Like, I've had that exact experience. I was told I had to stand up and speak French. I can't even speak English well. What do you think French is going to be like? So you make an adjustment, say, hey, we are going to confirm knowledge a different way. It doesn't mean she doesn't know it. It's just we're not going to do it so publicly. And that's, I think that's the problem when you have children who are masking and internalizing things, that they don't see that the accommodations like that are necessary, but they absolutely are, because having an anxious child, that's impactful in their classroom experience.
We talked earlier about, I said that there was a teacher at the school that we're at and she had my daughter for 2 years and now she has my son.
Yes.
And I noticed that the teacher that I think is really great, and I don't keep going on about her, but I think you've made so many good points around there's very simple things that we can do that will really impact kids. For example, there's a teacher at my kid's school and when they do the oral presentation, which they have to do, and I have a few problems with how the whole thing works. Okay, let's just leave it there. But one of the teachers who I think is great, I've never had a conversation with her about it, but my daughter was carrying on about it. She was very stressed about it. And when she got home that afternoon, I was like, how did it go? And she said, oh, it was great because I just picked one friend and I just did it right at the start of lunch with just one friend.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's great. And I said, oh, how did you go? She goes, oh, it was really good. And I don't know what I was so worried about, because I think she was probably thinking I should have trusted my teacher because I had a great connection, that it wouldn't have been a problem.
Mm.
But then I said to her, the friend that she picked is very out there. Mm. And I said, how did it work with her? Because I would have thought she would want more people.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, everyone got to pick. So she said, my friend did it to the whole grade.
I love that.
But my daughter got to pick one person and that ticked the box. And that was no conversation with, like, just an inclusion. And that's not, you get it because you got this label. It was like, everyone gets to pick.
Yeah. Because not neurotypical, neurodiverse, talking in public is either you take it or you don't. And it doesn't matter if you're neurodiverse or if you're neurotypical. But also, I really love that, what that teacher's done. She has given the children a choice in their learning. So she's like, I still have an outcome I have to meet, but let's change it to make sure all of the kids can absolutely reach that outcome to the best that they can without feeling anxious or worried, and gave them options. It's not about saying, oh, you know, you've got to, and being rigid. The outcome still occurred. You still reached the goal. You still did it in front of a public person or someone else, the teacher and your friend. But that's it. You weren't rigid. You adapted it and allowed children to have the safety of feeling heard that, okay, I'm not really comfortable talking in front of the whole class. I actually find that terrifying. And allowing them to be able to reach their fullest potential with the outcome of the learning, which is awesome.
Oh, I love what you've said, because I often talk in my personal life about, why would a child trust you with a problem if you can't solve anything small?
Yeah.
And one of the biggest arguments I've ever had in my life with a school was around a teacher not opening my daughter's lunchbox when she was in grade one. And they said that it was her responsibility to open her own lunchbox, but actually I had put it in the dishwasher. It was not dishwasher friendly and it was stuck.
Yeah.
And she's not a needy child that's dramatic. Like, she's internalizing, like, she'll never ask you for anything. And she asked her teacher, can you open my lunchbox? I can't get it open. The teacher said, it's your responsibility to open your own lunchbox. Refused to open it. She didn't eat anything all day. And when I picked her up, she was a mess. I opened the lunchbox. And I was like, this isn't like you. Why didn't you eat your food? She says, teacher didn't open the lunchbox for me. Okay. So then when I go into the school and I say, hey, what is this about the lunchbox? She said, it's her responsibility, whatever it is, right? And we'd already had NCCD funding. So it wasn't like she had no idea that there was anything going on. And then we had this standoff. And I said to her, if you cannot open her lunchbox, what trust does she have that you can help her in anything? Yeah. And she was like, well, you know, she'll come and tell me if there was anything.
You can't open this simple lunchbox. I'm not going to tell you I need to go to the toilet. I'm going to hold it all day and probably pee my pants. It's not even about making the responsibility. I am a human being. I have a kid in you, one, who is asking for help, regardless of whose bloody responsibility it is. The kid's not going to eat their lunch. I'm going to open the damn lunchbox. Regardless of teaching responsibility, there are other ways to do it. Fundamentally, that child has to eat. That is the key thing in that moment. And I'm sorry, that woman, bloody hell, I would have gone toe-to-toe with her. There's no way I would have accepted it.
Yes, yes. I can tell you that it didn't end well.
Yeah, but see, in that moment, you pointed out a fundamental flaw that she probably wasn't aware she had, and that was my way or the highway. I'm the authority figure, and that what I say has to happen. And this is a problem within our education system, as particularly when we are making adjustments and trying to get things help for our students. If you have a teacher who has that belief, it is their way or the highway, and that there is no middle ground, and that the adjustments aren't necessarily because I don't think they are. It doesn't matter if you have 36 years of experience or 36 minutes. It doesn't matter. It is about making sure that that child's voice is heard, that child's need is met, and that you are listening to engaging parents. And you are absolutely right. If you can yell at a six-year-old and can't take it from a curt tone from a parent, then you are in the wrong profession, because you are going to get that the rest of the time. You can't expect to be authoritative to students, but then not have the absolute ultimate authority person, the parent, giving you the information and then you thinking you know better. Get stuffed.
I think, and I went toe-to-toe with the principal on it.
Oh, good.
Oh, yeah. No, I was not. And I actually said to the principal, I said, this is actually completely your fault, this entire situation, because that particular teacher had two kids under two. She had postnatal depression, I found out later.
Yeah.
And I felt horrible about it.
Yeah.
She was split teaching with someone who was about to be retired, and they made a high needs classroom in a state school and then put a heap of internalizers right in the middle of it as the example of good behavior, right?
Yeah.
And so, in fairness to that teacher for a moment, she had kids jumping out windows, running through doors, right?
Yeah.
Then I've got a child who's an internalizer that says, can I open can you open my lunchbox?
So she's already met the threshold.
Totally.
Yeah.
But it goes back to my point, because when you have
internalizing kids that don't ask for anything ever.
Yeah.
I think they need to be catered for in a different way.
Absolutely.
One of my best friends in the world has externalizing children and I have internalizing.
Yeah.
And when we hang out together, no, I better be careful about that because she'll probably listen to that. Sorry. Sorry, I just was like, she will listen to this. She'll know and I won't be able to say it nicely.
Mm.
I have a friend up here on the coast and she is – I have a friend up here on the coast and she has externalizing children. She is dating a man. They're in a very long-term relationship who has internalizing children.
Yeah.
And what I've noticed when I hang out with them is the externalizing girls particularly are very vocal about what they need. And it's never ending and they never stop talking and they never finish their needs.
Yeah.
Her partner has, I think it's two children and they are internalizing children. And when I hang out with them, I notice that when the internalizers ask for anything like, can you open this drink? Can I do this? Can I have a swim now? Where's my towel? They're almost ignored because they have the externalizing needs over here. And I was talking to my friend recently about it because I said to her, do you treat them differently in that when one of the internalizers says, hey, can you open my can? Does it ever occur to you that they might have been waiting for like 30 minutes? Like, can we cater to the needs differently in that we know that this kid over here has got 40 in an hour and this kid's got one in 6 hours? But when you're so freaking busy with the externalizers, yeah. That one question is like, can you just wait a minute and you never come back to them?
No. Yeah.
Do you know what? Do you think that's important here?
It is really important. It's really important both in general in parenting and families because I'm going to do two things. So I have an internalizing daughter. She's the oldest. So on top of that, she's a girl and she's got the oldest sister mentality. So that's a struggle. Then my middle child who has high complex needs is an externalizer. And so I will admit his needs do in some cases are much louder and get fixed first. And I have had to be incredibly deliberate making sure that my daughter's needs are also being met even when I'm not hearing them, because that's something I'm aware of. And that became, you know, she's 12 now, so that's gone into my teaching practice. But that's hard, okay? And that takes a lot of self-reflection and understanding of yourself. And I'm not expecting parents to be like that. And I'm not expecting teachers. But I do think fundamentally there are different needs for an externalizing child and an internalizing child, massively different needs. They are not going to look the same. Their learning plans are not going to look the same. And because they're so different. And their needs, while they, you know, the externalizer is able to ask for it, the internalizers are not in some cases, or don't feel confident enough to, or as you said, the person's not going to come back to it. So they're kind of, in some cases, can go, I'm just not going to ask. It's easier. And I'm not talking about parenting. I'm now onto schools.
Yeah. And if they actually ask,
then
it's critical.
It's critical you act on it, because otherwise you end up severing and destroying a relationship between you and a student, or you, because they've asked, you haven't been able to, you know, follow through with what you said. And then if you don't follow up later when you do remember by apologizing, then you have severed that trust and they just will not ask you. And that's really hard. And developing trust with a student is something, you know, that is a sacred thing. You must try and keep that. And if you do accidentally break it by ignoring the internalizer who has asked for something, you need to make sure you go back and repair.
Agreed. And again, this goes back to the system.
Yes.
Because if we have teachers that have got no resources or very, very tiny amounts of resources to help the externalizers that are really, if they have limited resources to even help the externalizers, like you were talking last episode about teachers spending money.
Yeah.
Was that recorded?
Yeah.
It was recorded. Spending money. I didn't think it was.
Maybe it wasn't.
Okay. No, sorry. You and I were talking at lunch about how sometimes you've noticed that teachers will spend money out of their own resources to get sensory products, to get, you know, a wobble chair or a tent or whatever it is that they need, because it will drastically improve their day and the kids' day and the equilibrium of the whole classroom. So when you have that happening, when they're spread so freaking thin, it's so difficult to get a teacher to stack on top of that, the internalizing child,
to try to get them to speak up of what they need, because they can't, they can barely deal with what they've got now.
Yep. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I am seeing it where teachers are spending their own money, and I am one of those teachers. I do it. When I go do sub days, I make sure I have a bag and it's got extra snacks. It's got extra fidget toys, because I find even in mainstream classes where there is maybe only one neurodivergent child, all of the neurotypical children also benefit from it, and therefore will benefit the neurodiverse child. It just means that my teaching experience is much nicer in that day. But they need to, the schools need to be, I guess, you can't just pigeonhole a child by going, you're easy, you don't really need much, we're not going to do it. So, and then rely on a teacher to try and fund things that they're like, this might help or this would help. It's not fair. They're already paid a pittance. Sorry, guys, I'm just going to say that. They're paid a pittance. They are experiencing, there is a prolonged amount of, we're now seeing with behaviours that are concerning, teachers are getting hurt and things like that. We know this. That is a bigger issue than just ADHD. That is now becoming a society issue. So I'm not going to go on that tangent, but that there are bigger things at play. But the teachers themselves, those people, if they are spending their own money on resources and you are seeing that as a parent, then I promise that they are trying for your child. And it is a matter of having communication with the child, with the teacher, and engaging, and sometimes having to offer your own, hey, I'm letting you know that this is what my kid is needing, even if you don't know what the classroom situation is like, because I don't think that they're not caring. I think they just don't know. They don't understand internalized behavior.
I agree. And I think you said it so well when you talked about having your son and your daughter. And I have a similar thing with my daughter all the time where, like, I remember recently we went to the Ed Sheeran concert, and we're at the concert and, you know, you reflect on yourself as a parent, and sometimes I just, like, you always want to do better.
Yeah,
right?
Always.
And we were at the, like, I don't go to concerts. I'm not really a concert person. I don't like the experience. I don't like lots of people. I don't like any of it. I didn't even really go to concerts very often when I was in my 20s.
You went just quietly. I couldn't.
You know, it's always that thing when you're booking it, it feels okay. And then you're like, what the fuck are we doing
here? Why did I make this decision?
Why are we here? So we were there. And I am not at my best because I don't do well in crowds.
Yeah.
I have a fear that one of my kids is going to get taken. You know, it's all the mum things, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm stressed. My levels of stress are high. No one's even asked for anything yet.
Yeah.
I've got two boys who ask a lot, and I've got one daughter that doesn't. And I was clearly getting flustered with the amount of toilet times, the amount of food that wasn't right. Then it's a whole thing.
Yeah.
You've got to push past so many people. I'm trying to figure out what to do. One of my kids does a wee like every 15 wees a movie. Like, he does 15 wees in 60 minutes sometimes. And I'm like, what are we going to do here? And then I came back and my husband had given him a Gatorade, which he drank.
Oh,
he drank like a whole Gatorade. And I was like, oh my God, we're stuck in the corner. We've got to go past 30 people to get in and out. Like I was just stressed.
Yeah.
And then my daughter said to me something like, can I have your phone? Because she wanted to take a video. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what I said exactly, but it was probably like, oh, not now, or I can't do it right now, or I'm trying to text daddy about where he is, or like, she goes, oh, I'm sorry, I'm trying not to ask for anything.
Oh, yes. Oh, my God. Oh.
I felt fucking sick.
You feel, yeah. Oh, I've been there. Yep.
I just felt like crying.
Yeah.
To be like, I feel teary now.
Yeah.
Because I thought, oh, my God. Like, yep. I am the person that is all about that. That is, the whole podcast is built on that.
Yeah.
And my daughter is sitting there going, I'm trying not to ask for anything. And I realized how often she does that in my own home.
So what's she doing at school?
What's she doing at school? And what hope do other kids have?
Yeah.
Because I think I couldn't be any more attuned to her and that presentation. And that's me doing that.
But see, I think there's an element of grace in that you recognize that. And I'm assuming you've repaired in that moment or after the fact.
Totally.
Yes.
You know what? We should talk about that, actually.
Yeah.
Because as soon as she said it,
yeah,
I felt shame.
Yep.
100%. I went straight to shame. What a terrible mother I am. Mm-hmm. I cannot believe that I am making her feel so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
She probably wishes that I hadn't bought her and the boys, and I should have gone just with my husband, and she hasn't even asked for anything. And she's actually, the kids have actually been great.
Yeah.
And I just can't believe what an awful person I was. Like, you know, like that, my yeah. internal dialogue goes straight there. I'm an awful mother. And I immediately wanted to get out of the moment by like opening a drink or whatever it is that she wanted and then just glaze over the top of it.
Yeah.
And I forced myself, even though I felt such shame, to say to her, I'm getting so upset.
No, I get it.
I said to her, I'm so sorry. I said, I don't cope well at concerts. Mm. I don't like loud noise. I don't like a lot of crowds. Mm. As soon as we walked in, I'm actually really stressed out. And so you have every right to ask for a drink or ask my friend to take a photo. It's not about you.
Yeah.
It's about me and that I'm already at 9 out of 10. And that's not your fault.
Yeah.
And I think that was my best attempt at repair.
It's a brilliant one.
She looked at me and was like, yeah, I know.
They do. They know. In those moments, they know. The kids know that neurodivergent children are so observant. They know. And my kids the same. And like I'll relate it. I have a classroom situation where I had the same thing. I said something to a student, not fully knowing their background, and I upset them. And they left my classroom. And then I had to think about it. I was like, what did I do? I didn't have all the background. So when I went out to go, okay, I need to repair this situation. I have done something. I had to have. Like, what have I walked into? And I sat down next to them and they didn't want a bar of me. And I get it. I get it. And you know what? And I said, listen, I really want to fix what's happened. I've missed something. I'm human. I'm trying really hard. I apologize. I wasn't really thinking today. And I had to share something with her. I said, listen, my dad's gone in for heart surgery this morning. I'm really all over the place. You know, that doesn't have any bearing for you. But can you tell me what I said that made you have the need to leave my classroom? And she looked at me and she said, is your dad really in the hospital? I said, yes, he's having heart surgery. He has a block. And she just goes, why the hell are you here then? I said, oh, honey, thank you so much. That's really beautiful. And she goes, oh, well, what you said was, you know, she told me. And then she gave me the background and I said, and I felt small in what I did. And I said, I am so sorry. I didn't know that. And that's me saying that wasn't a representation of knowing that. I didn't. And she goes, okay, well, thanks for sharing with me. I feel better. I'll come back into class after lunch. And I was like, for me, that moment was big. I'm not telling your teachers that you need to be sharing with all your students.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that. But I had, in that moment, I needed to repair with that student. They have obviously internalized something that I've said. And instead of having a massive breakdown in the classroom, they just decided to leave and walk out, which I actually commend because I don't want them to feel that they have to sit there and be uncomfortable in that moment. And yeah, I was like, the only way I can get like for you to understand is to know that I'm not perfect. I'm having a day too. You know, I'm really worried about my dad. And you know what? You know what that kid did the next day? Even though I made them feel absolute rotten, but unintentionally, the next day they came in and they had a little handmade card for me. This kid is 15.
God.
Like 15. And they had a little card that said, I hope your dad's okay. And I was just like, I feel tiny and small, but amazing at the same time because you were a bigger person than I was. Like, you know what I mean? Kids are amazing. And I think that the rigidity of the education system is failing all children because I don't believe education has to be look a simple way at a desk and be this. We know through neurodivergent students it doesn't need to look that way, and it will only benefit neurotypical children if we went a different way. Being rigid and unflexible in learning is failing all children, not just neurodiverse, all of them.
Thank you so much. This has been such a great episode series with you. I really want to thank you for all your time and your patience with the baptism of fucking fire it has been here. If you would like to find out any more about Bronnie, I'm going to put her notes into the show notes. I'm going to put all of her information. She has just moved into educational advocacy. Is that correct?
Yeah, education and consultancing. So I will be also working, hopefully, with schools and even daycares to be able to develop understanding around neurodivergence in a lived way, if that makes sense. Not just a, this is what we say on paper sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And Bronnie's also someone who understands how a classroom works. A lot of the time, I always think about it. I'm like, am I being ridiculous? Is this possible? I don't know. Yeah. Bronnie is somebody who does know,
yeah,
because she's done both. So if you'd like to have, if you'd like to find out more about her, I'm going to put all into the show notes. Oh, it's important. Hang on. Yes. If you have any more questions for Bronnie, please fill out into the show notes on WhatsApp. You can send in an audio or a listener question via written, and I can ask Bronnie very nicely if she'd be willing to come back in. If anyone has any more questions, absolutely send them in. Send me an email, send Bronnie an email, and let her know that you loved it. Thank you so much for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend, review the podcast, and reach out to us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Press record.
Quick announcement. Did you know that we have an ADHD Mums shop filled with resources designed just for you? These resources are packed with answers to the most frequently asked questions I get sent in via email. Everything from understanding ADHD and autism to practical tips for daily life. There's also a free assessment tool. If you're wondering about ADHD or autism for yourself or your little one, don't forget to check out the free assessment tool under free resources section on my website, adhdmums.com.au.